It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We examine now a social phenomenon, the opportunistic appropriation of Indigenous identity by non-Indigenous people, why it's happening and what it means in shifting racial landscapes. The movement has been described with words like pretendian, words like wannabe. Join in with your comments throughout. Call in with a question, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Attorney Jean Taye is here, wrote a report on Indigenous identity fraud for the University of Saskatchewan. Jean, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Nice to meet you and nice to be here, Kate.
Good morning. And we also have Audra Simpson, a Mohawk member, professor of anthropology at Columbia University, and a distinguished visiting professor in the Department of Race, Diaspora, and Indigeneity at the University of Chicago. Audra, welcome.
Thanks so much, Kate. It's a pleasure to be here.
I want to ask you both to level set. First impressions of this problem. How widespread is Indigenous identity fraud? Jean, you first.
I wouldn't want to give any data for the United States, but for Canada, I think we're talking well over 100,000 people across the country. Probably closer to 200,000, maybe as many as a quarter of a million. But that's not just in academia, obviously. We've got the largest numbers coming from those primarily in Eastern Canada, Ontario, Quebec, and the Maritimes, who are looking to cash in on what they think is some kind of gravy train of hunting and fishing rights. And some of them are doing it to stop Indigenous land claims. And so that's mostly men in academia and government across the country, all levels of government, local, municipal, provincial, and federal. We have mostly women. And the marvelous Dr. Kim Tallbear estimates that as much as 25% of the so-called Indigenous faculty at universities in Canada are frauds. So that just gives you an idea of the scope in Canada.
Audra, how do you examine the scope across the border in the United States?
The United States has a longstanding, I would say, you know, it's documented since the American Revolution that there's a long tradition in the United States of playing Indian. We have the Lakota cultural historian Phil DeLoria's wonderful book, Playing Indian, to give us that sense of history. So this practice of adopting and adorning oneself in what is supposed to be the clothing and the attitude of Indigenous peoples hails back to the Boston Tea Party. Phil DeLoria argued that this was part of the process of reconciling the impossibility of being in place and not being of place and making one's identity in a so-called new world. Now, this was not a new world. This was a world that was and still is occupied by people who predate the presence of non-Indigenous people here. So I would say this has a long tradition in the United States that's as old as the United States itself. I would say on the specific question of the present and the academy in particular, my guess is that there's at least one in every port in a major R1. This is something that, you know, has been at times an open secret. It's also been an open door because self-identification is the law, and folks have moved along from early stages of their careers, like at the point of undergraduate, by self-identifying without any verification. And they've grown and cultivated themselves in institutions like undergrad, grad, and have of late been found out. Because this is, you know, no longer, I would say it's still institutionally tolerated because it's the law, but there is this conversation and this sense of critique around it beyond the institutions, which is really long overdue. So that is what I can say for now. We do need good aggregate data in the United States for this. I wish a sociologist would take this on. It's desperately needed research.
I wonder, as I listen to you, Audra, like when people rise through the ranks in their, you know, whether it's academia or rise through the ranks in their expertise, becoming thought leaders or experts in an area, is this an extension of colonialism?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, Kate, and I would say it absolutely is. Colonialism takes many forms. It's not just, you know, we have the settler colonial variant, which is literally, you know, moving Indigenous peoples out of the way in order to take land, right? That's a clear material process. Some people tend to think of it only in those terms, but what we have now is moving Indigenous peoples out of the way, inhabiting versions of them that are recognizable to settlers. Settlers think they know Indians when they see them, but they don't, right? The recent one that was outed in University of California, Berkeley, really to me as a person from the nation that she long claimed saw her as a German hobbyist. I've seen that before in Germany. However, white people think they know Indians because of the ways in which indigeneity or the figure of the Indian occupies the white imagination in the United States through cowboy and Indian films, et cetera, through branding, through mascotting. And these folks will inhabit those stereotypes. In doing so, they get a lot of attention. They are immediately recognizable. White people think to them. And then they launch themselves. They're very ambitious. They're very, you know, they don't come with the baggage that many of us come from. And I'm calling it baggage, but what it is colonial trauma. And they proceed at breakneck speed to occupy every and take every opportunity available to not only Indigenous people or Native people, but other minoritized people in the United States. So when they take those Ford Foundation fellowships that are now no longer available, they're taking that away also from Latinx, Black, et cetera. You know, so this is just, to me, it's unconscionable, but it has been encouraged by the lack of verification and the absolute ignorance regarding our communities, our membership policies, our modes of governance, which is really where the question of indigeneity resides.
Audra Simpson, there, Columbia University anthropology professor, and Jean Taye with us, our guides to Indigenous identity fraud. Jean, Canada-based Indigenous rights attorney. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions. Jean, we heard from Lisa in Madison called in, and Lisa says that they have a friend who no one would guess is Native, has a great grandmother who they say is Native. They don't know who that person is. And Lisa says they wonder if it is inappropriate for their friend to claim Native status if it's that distant. Is that appropriate?
In my personal opinion, no, it's not appropriate. Having an ever so great Indian grandmama is a very common way that people, they use it as like a passport into what they think is indigeneity. Some of them go back like hundreds of years. Some of them will find, because genealogy is a modern pastime for a lot of people, and they go back into their history and they'll find an Indian grandmama back in the 1600s or the 1700s, and they will then parlay that into a new identity. I think it's nothing more than an interesting fact. If you interesting genealogical fact, if you have an ever so great Indian grandmother, you'll notice they're almost always an Indian princess or something like that. That doesn't work. The idea of Indigenous identity is not based on family lore, especially unsubstantiated family lore. And it's not based on these ancient questions. When we're asked as Indigenous people who you are, what we usually say is, who are you? Who are your people? Who is your grandmother? Who are your people and where are you from? Meaning, and we don't mean 4 or 5, 20 generations back. We mean right now. Who are your people? So I'm a Red River Métis. I'm born and raised on the banks of the Red River. My grandmother was Sarah Riel. Riel might not mean a lot in the United States, but in Canada, it's an instantly recognizable Indigenous name. And the Red River is an instantly recognizable Métis community. So that's what I say. And that's what we usually do. So if Audra and I were to get together, she'd say she's from Ganawage, and I'd say, well, I'm a Red River Métis. And we usually would have a, oh, do you know, da, 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 da. It's a way of checking who's in your community, what community, and does your community accept you as a member? Because it's a two-way street. This is not like individual identity, like saying you're gay or that you have a certain religion, it which you get to choose, and it doesn't matter what anybody else says. This is a two-way street because you're part of an Indigenous people. And one of the big rights of the people is to determine who their own members are. So Audra, for example, would never say that she's from Ganawage if Ganawage said, no, you're not. You know, and I would never say I'm a Red River Métis without my community saying, yeah, we accept you. And that's part of the problem with this self-identification issue, is because those people think that this is a freestanding right to pick up an, any identity they want. It's part of almost like the American dream, and by that I would include Canada, to create your own identity. And that's where this falls down, because it doesn't work that way.
Thank you so much for that scenario and that clarity. Appreciate that. Indigenous rights lawyer Jean Taye and anthropologist Audra Simpson here leading us in the discussion on why white people appropriate non-white identities. Call in with questions and comments any point, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As more and more people reject whiteness, we examine this movement of individuals who previously identified as white, now claiming to be Native American, and how it impacts Native communities and First Nations. Join in with your comments. The number to call in with a question is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Columbia University Professor of Anthropology Audra Simpson and attorney Jean Taye, Counsel on Aboriginal Rights and Negotiations, Expertise in Indigenous Identity Fraud. They stay with us. Let's bring in Tina now in La Crosse. Tina, hi, go ahead.
Hi. I had to wonder if some people are just simply mistaken. My story is, I was always raised and told I was from Munsee descent. We're Scotch-Irish, upstate Pennsylvania, but had the paperwork of the woman that married McCarty, one of my ancestors, and it was sort of kept alive as a family story. There was, I mean, I've been visiting with my family. I've been to where she's buried, because nobody ever moved up there for generations. But there was a whole family story that she married this gentleman that came up from Philadelphia, and that's sort of where the whole family came from, even though it was 5-6 generations back. Well, then I got 23andMe and found out, no, I'm not any Munsee ancestrally at all. I am Scotch-Irish. Now, we had the paperwork. So it was it she married in after children were born. It's too far back in time to know the why. There's no money involved. There's no land or anything that came with it. But really, until I was 51 years old, I thought one of my ancestors was a woman from the Munsee group.
Tina, thank you for sharing your story. Audra, what about that family lore meets DNA testing?
Right. That's, you know, I think that story or a variation on that story is fairly common in the United States as people make sense of themselves and the project of being in a place that belongs to others, right? In the move to indigeneity is part of that process of making sense of oneself in a place that belongs to others, I think. And I'm not going to say this is the caller's purpose at all, but it is a really interesting way of sidestepping the project of colonization and dispossession in the United States, is to then claim an identity that is of the place without verifying it. The caller does not express that project, that intent at all. There's a kind of, you know, innocence to it. There's a story that was handed down. You know, there are names. There has been recourse to, you know, a visit to a gravesite, etc. I personally have no problem with those stories. I get it. Like, you know, people tell stories in their families. They sometimes those stories veer from what may be the verifiable truth with, you know, records and other oral historians in the family. Where I have a problem with it, and, you know, the caller also said, you know, she reached the age of 51 and then realized otherwise. What I have problems with and other people in Indigenous nations have problems with is the move to then tick a box, identify oneself, dress up in what often is a parodic version or a fantasist version of Indigenous peoples, and move into our spaces and taking and the theft of our, I'm calling it theft at this point, the theft of opportunity. So this caller is not saying that there. And then the move to DNA, like as a mode of verification, I want to discourage people from doing that. Although it may seem like it's the final arbiter of truth, it's not. What is our documents and conversations with the community, the nation, the reservation, the elders in those places that you are claiming, that those are the final arbiters of truth. DNA also goes totally around and under and undermines Indigenous sovereignty and communities. I have DNA probably from Dutch, wherever the Dutch are, Denmark. I have never been there. I do not speak Danish. I have no business up in their business. I have no business asking for a passport from those people. I have no connection to them, but I probably have that DNA. That to give you an example.
Can I pipe in on the DNA thing, it, just to add to what Audrey was saying? By the way, the Dutch are from Holland, not Denmark. On the DNA, first of all, you have to understand that when you do one of those DNA tests, A, they don't give you your full genetic heritage. So you have to read the fine print in the multiple pages that they send you. But for example, most of them do eat only one line of your DNA. So they'll do like what we call the mitochondrial DNA. I'll stay away from the technical talk, but that would be your mother's 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 line. Right. And so it's not your mother's father's mother's line or anything like that. You have every generation, your ancestors double, and the mitochondrial is one tiny thread. So by the time you get back to like 7 or 8 generations, what it's giving you is less than 1% of less than 1% of your ancestry. So and it only follows those lines. So you're not getting the full picture. That's one thing. And then the other thing is that DNA is nothing more than a cellular statement about where you are. Oh, it's not even cellular, right? It's even below that level. So it has nothing to do with identity. It has nothing to do with your heritage in a meaningful way, or your modern day present in this body identity. So DNA, those companies are selling a fantasy. And so it doesn't tell you anything. Now, for that caller, she says she always thought she had this ever so great grandmother who was from a particular tribe. That actually still may be true, because 23andMe wouldn't follow, say, the father's mother's mother. It would only follow the father's father's father or the mother's mother's mother's. Hmm. So, but anyway, all of that to say you cannot rely on DNA. It doesn't tell you the full story. And even if it did, it's not worth anything in terms of identity. It's only telling you something that is about ancient history. And then there are lots of other caveats on this. First of all, it's never going to zero in on which tribe you're from. It just says Native American ancestry. Right?
And we need to pause right there, Attorney Jean Taye and University of Chicago Distinguished Visiting Professor of Anthropology, Audra Simpson. As we talk about the complexities in this movement, and you're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the trend of what some call racial shifting. The number of people who say they are Native American showing staggering growth in U.S. Census figures over a decade. We have Jean Taye, author, lawyer, Indigenous rights advocate based in Canada, and professor of anthropology, Audra Simpson's research at the intersection of Indigenous and settler society, politics, history, based at the University of Chicago. Let's bring on another call, Liz in Dodgeville. Liz, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hi. I just had another thought. I totally agree. It's totally egregious, these appropriations for people in academia and getting scholarships, but I think it would be interesting to hear, like, other reasons why people might want to identify with Native America, Native American history. Our own family, our great-grandmother was Native American. My grandmother was blonde-haired, blue-eyed, and all of her sisters had black hair and black eyes. And as my grandmother got older near her death, she revealed that her mom, who was a midwife, had had an affair with a local physician who was Irish. And so our own family was very sad to learn that we did not have any of that. And so for us, it was a point of pride because of our sense that Native American people took better care of the earth and were wiser in many ways. So besides the sinister reasons that people might want to appropriate this identity, I think it'd be interesting to explore why other people might want to claim some of that identity. And that's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Liz. Jean, can you start us off there?
Sure. I think that there's lots of reasons, and I think everybody's fascinated by why someone would want to change their identity, often when they're in their adult lives. So that's a fascinating sort of psychological discussion. But I think the most obvious reason that people change their identities is basically opportunity and greed, that they are prepared to assume an entirely new identity in order to take advantage of an opportunity, because there may be a placement in a university for an Indigenous professor, and they can take that opportunity. They can get published. They can have a microphone, they can make money, and they see this as an opportunity. But there's another one, and I'll just stop with that because there's multiple reasons, but this is a bit of a move to innocence, right? This idea that, well, we're not the colonial people who took the land, and we're not the ones who hurt Native Americans. We're the innocent ones because we're you. And so that is
a release of
guilt. And I didn't yeah, exactly. And I didn't create that phrase move to innocence, and I'm sorry I can't remember who did, but Audra might. But it is this idea that you're sort of classically whitewashing the history of your ancestors and flipping it around, and then you are like part of the the better, on the side of the better angels.
Hmm. Audra, other reasons why people want to be Native? What is really behind racial shifting?
That's a great question. I think that there are multiple reasons, and Jean is correct to underscore of late this desire to bypass, I think, the colonial history of the U.S. and what is now the U.S. and Canada, but also and to, you know, achieve and to go to the, of all, you know, we're like the poorest of the poor. So this just, it's hard for me not to like underscore how egregious this is in light of that. Mm. But they do sort of accelerate with these opportunities, right? So, so there's that with the opportunities that are for the poorest of the poor, right? Because these are white folks, largely white folks, who don't come with this sort of personal histories that we might come with, you know, so they're, you know, very adept at taking GREs and, you know, LSATs and whatnot. So there's that. But I do think in the States, as I mentioned initially, there is this, the indigenous occupies a space of longing, of fantasy, of a better than version of what is already here. So it's a combination of a kind of cycle, which we don't have literature on yet, the psychology of this, right? Hmm. The psychology of trying to move out of whiteness, move out of a settler identity, of disavowing the kind of history that has enabled this place to come into being, and the ways in which we have been the sort of symbolic foil and site of becoming for people to move out of those difficult histories. At the same time, we're noticing a trend where in particular, white women are also claiming trauma and what mm-hmm. may, and using that trauma to indigenicize themselves. So you have, in the case of Mary Ellen Terpel LaFond, Cheyenne Turion, Elizabeth Hoover, you have this, you know, sort of gesture towards family trauma that makes their indigeneity unknowable, unsightable, a difficult topic. And that is supposed to stand in for their claim. I want to say there is trauma in Indigenous communities. Do you know what that trauma is? It's caused by the settlement and the dispossession of our lands, being put into residential schools or boarding schools in the States, the profound violence that accompanied those processes. So yeah, there is trauma, but that is not theirs to claim. So you have these white folks who have like violence in their histories, but they take that, as some folks are want to have, but they take that and convert that into a claim of indigeneity. So this is a remarkable move. It is remarkable, and it's more and more pervasive, we're finding in these cases.
Audra brings up the Indigenous children taken from their homes, placed in these boarding schools, brutally forced to assimilate, happened in the U.S. and Canada. Jean, taking that in context, could the growth of people self-identifying as Indigenous reflect more people discovering their family histories?
Well, it's part of this trend about North Americans, because I think Canadians and Americans are the same, and is to want to know their history. Mm-hmm. And this is a relatively new phenomenon. I'm going to put this in the context of the fact that people came here, white people, mostly Europeans, came here from countries in order to ditch their histories, right? To get rid of their history as Irish or German or Italians. They came here in order to blend in and become something different, right? Mm. And so many people, it's really interesting because most Indigenous people, we can rattle off our histories for seven generations at least, usually. But most Americans really don't know anybody beyond their grandmother or maybe their great-grandmother. They don't know their histories. So there's a trend, I'd say in the last 20 years or so, maybe a little longer, that people are starting to do genealogy as a hobby, as a pastime. And when they find these other identities, it helps them to feel more grounded in this Canadian and American company. And I would also pose this as a theory that's just mine own, but I don't have any data on it, that I, I'm sensing that most white Americans and most white Canadians find that just having an American identity or a Canadian identity is somehow not enough. It's lacking something. And so they're looking for a different way of expressing who they are than just being an American. So it helps them to, it helps their sense of being something more by claiming another, a little hyphenated addition on, so they can be Native American. And that one they like because they see themselves as on a nicer side than on as than the colonials. And so I think that's something of what's going on here, is that the state identity is somehow vacuous or lacking in something, and they want something more.
Interesting, as the psychology unfolds as well and the research alongside Canada-based Indigenous rights attorney Jean Taye there, and we have Columbia University anthropology professor Audra Simpson. You can join in questions on Indigenous identity fraud. What comes up? 800-642-1234. Laura in Appleton. Hi, Laura. Go ahead.
Hi. I have kind of the opposite experience of what you're describing. I grew up with my dad as my primary caretaker because our mother had a lot of issues that we didn't, we weren't able to have visitation much with her. But she always said that we were Native American and that we were Ojibwe from Red Cliff. And my dad always told us we weren't enough to enroll because he had this concept of percentages and blood quantum meaning. And he in his math mind said you aren't enough of a percentage, when the tribe said it's descendancy and the base roles. And my mother's mother, so my grandmother, was put in an orphanage when she was 6 years old. And come to find out, we didn't really know her family. Her dad was enrolled, and so was she. But because she was put in the orphanage at such a young age, they were very against her and her siblings continuing to use the language and the traditions. Mm. She became very ashamed of that and passed that on to my mother, who also was taken away from her because my grandmother and my mother had a lot of issues with trauma, to be frank. And so I grew up white, but my mom did get enrolled, and I was told by the tribe, you're eligible to be enrolled. So now I'm trying to embrace that I am indeed, this is my family, and being the tribe did tell me to go on Ancestry, and I have trace my roots all the way to Chief Buffalo, who signed the treaty on Madeline Island to keep the Ojibwe tribes around Lake Superior from having to be moved west.
Laura, so, I'm going to jump in here. Thank you so much for calling in. Audra, go ahead.
Laura, I think your story is, yes, it appears to be the opposite, but this is very much a story that is, I mean, this is a real story. This is how this story of disconnection and hopefully reconnection, for lack of a better term, rekindling will one day be normative, will one day be the norm. People were taken from their families. People were disconnected. People were told that they were less than human, that indigeneity was savagery, that, you know, they shouldn't learn their languages, et cetera, et cetera. And you're telling a story also of a kind of colonial carcerality, of being fostered, of people being taken away from families. My only hope is that you can rekin yourself, to use terms that Joanne Barker has used in her book, her recent book on the state's indigenous terrorist, but that you are a kin, you are an indigenous person with kinship. And that is something that is not property, that's an active form of being. And I hope that you activate that. I hope that you go back and you reconnect with your family, and that this feels like a full and active relationship, right? These are sets of relationships that you can activate. But those stories of disconnection and trauma are very much of a piece with what we're talking about when we talk about contemporary coloniality that has attacked our families.
Audra, thank you. Jean, I want to make space for your reflections here as well.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I think it's a really interesting story too, and I agree with Audra. The story of people being disconnected. We have in Canada what we call the 60s scoop, where the state actively picked children, sometimes right out of their newborns, right out of their mother's arms, and took them away from the people. But my major point is this. I think that the biggest problem we have here is that both the United States and Canada treat Indigenous peoples as if we're a race. And we are not a race. We are peoples and nations. And nations are political entities. And we get to decide who our members are according to our own rules and traditions and customs, which would be easier if every Indigenous nation across North America had the same rules, but they don't, right? They've all got different ideas about it. And so what we're talking about here is not blood quantum or not whether you're enough of a race in order to be part of the people you're talking about. It's that they have told you that they're willing to accept you as, and I think Audra's using the right word, kin. Mm. And so you're part of the family. But there's a very good reason why the United States and Canada have shifted Indigenous people into being a race. It's because races don't have title and rights to land or resources or political rights. That's just the, and you've heard people on this call and talk about, well, I have blonde hair and blue eyes. It doesn't matter what you look like, because this isn't a racial question. It's about nations that, not states, but nations within North America that have certain members, and they have the rights to accept them or determine whether they're part of it. And you have a right, and this is what the caller is talking about, the right to belong according to those rules that nation establishes. So for myself, I think all the discussion about blood quantum, whether it's part of American law or not, is wrong. It's fundamentally the wrong way of looking about this. This is nations of people across North America who have rights and title to land and resources and political rights. And that's the way we should talk about it. So I think the whole word race shifting is wrong. It's the wrong way to look about it, because then you start talking about blood quantum and things like that. It's the wrong end of the lens. We shouldn't be looking at it through that lens.
Jean Taye there, Indigenous rights attorney in Canada. We have anthropology professor Audra Simpson examining what is happening, people making false claims of Native American heritage, and this larger conversation about whiteness and about tribal sovereignty. Join in the discussion, ask a question, 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine this troubling trend of claiming Indigenous status, people making blatantly fraudulent claims to advance their own interests, and how this fits into a legacy of a racist system, how it fits into colonialism. Still time to talk. Your question, 800-642-1234. We have distinguished visiting professor of anthropology at the University of Chicago, Audra Simpson, and attorney and author Jean Taye here as well. I want to turn toward solutions, Jean. In March, we see the University of Saskatchewan set up a website so applicants for Indigenous-specific jobs and scholarships can upload proof they belong to an Indigenous community. Is this an effective solution?
Yeah, that's what has to happen. We have moved beyond the era, at least in Canada, where you can simply self-identify and everybody goes, oh, yeah, okay, we'll give you the keys to the kingdom, to a point where there's a verification requirement now. So there is a responsibility now in most of the institutions in Canada to, I would say most of the academic institutions in Canada are moving towards a verification process. In other words, they won't just accept protect you by ticking off the box. You have to provide evidence of some kind that you are a member of a tribe or a First Nation or a Métis community or an Inuit area. So you have to, and that means that there have to be connections with those various peoples in order to get them to verify it for you. And so sometimes it's documentary evidence, but we're not limiting it to that. We're saying, well, if you don't have documents, which some people don't, then we'll look to a connection with the community to get them to orally, is somebody in the community, and I mean somebody with the ability to actually say something, not just an individual person, but someone who represents the collective, who will provide that evidence, either oral or documentary, in order to verify people who are going to take advantage of positions, either as a student or a faculty or staff, that are set aside or are looking for Indigenous people.
So, Audra, that being one example from academia as a way to, as a measure to address this, what other ways can we look at this? And we only have about a minute left as we seek solutions here.
Right. Thank you so much. I would co-sign that. That is not at all happening in the States. I think there needs to be a verification process communities have to be involved, that this moves beyond the individual into the collective. So it has to be an authority within the community that is representative of the collective. We've seen a lot of cases of elder grooming. We do not want to go to an elder who's been manipulated and deceived and ask them if this person is in fact of the community, because they might very well say that they are, and they themselves have been duped. There's an incredible machinery of manipulation that goes behind these identities also. So I'd like to see that. We'd all like to see some version of that happen in institutions in the U.S. as well.
Thank you both so much for joining us in this conversation.
You're so welcome. It's my pleasure.
Yeah, and thanks for having the conversation.
That was Indigenous rights attorney Jean Taye, wrote a report on Indigenous identity fraud for the University of Saskatchewan, also an author. And Audra Simpson is an enrolled Mohawk citizen of Kahnawake, is a professor of anthropology at Columbia University, and currently a distinguished visiting professor in the Department of Race, Diaspora, and Indigeneity at the University of Chicago. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.